This show is brought to you by Gobble by Kevin Carr, a Thanksgiving novelette of the zombie apocalypse, and you thought your family dinner was stressful. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Well, it's December, it's almost Christmas, and that means, of course, it is time for another Star Wars movie. This is the Lucasfilm slash Disney Christmas gift that we're going to be giving every single year. And this week, I'm going to be talking about Rogue One, a Star Wars story. I'll also be talking about a couple films that are out, like Collateral Beauty, Naruto, All Through the House, and Camera Store. I'm also going to be giving you some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, an interview with actor John Rhys Davies, and the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news is a little bit of a reaction to the Critics' Choice Movie Awards that, of course, came out last week. I'm a voting member. We had the ceremony on Sunday, and here's a couple of reactions to it. There's a lot of love for La La Land. And look, I said this last week, I think La La Land's a perfectly fine movie. It is a little bit like the LA Gear Shoes of movies, where I don't know if the people in Los Angeles are going to be all that into it. I mean, sort of like there's that opening sequence in Pretty Woman where the guy's walking down the street going, "Welcome to Hollywood! What's your dream? You dream? This is the land of dreams." That is an image to people who don't live in LA. People who live in LA, they have to deal with just being in LA. And it's also very common to have a movie that's about the film industry, or at the very least about the entertainment industry, do well in award season simply because it's a very navel-gazing, narcissistic society out there. Now, what's funny, the one award I voted on for La La Land was Emma Stone for Best Actress, but she didn't win. Jackie won that one, of course, Natalie Portman. I'm usually not a huge fan of the movies that get all the awards. Although Manchester by the Sea, I thought, certainly deserved its awards, and Casey Affleck getting Best Actor is fantastic. And I very much think that he is going to be a shoo-in for the Oscars. You know, every year there's always that shoo-in person who's going to win. I really think Casey Affleck's going to win for Manchester by the Sea, and I think Viola Davis is going to win for Fences. Natalie Portman's probably going to have a really good chance, although I wasn't completely taken in by her. But there's a lot of stuff that I voted on that didn't win. Like, Zootopia is such a great movie. It won for Best Animated Film. I voted for Kubo and the Two Strings simply because I love Laika and all the stuff that it does. So there are some things that I was a little bit surprised, but overall, these are pretty predictable, and I think that's going to go all the way through award seasons, through the Globes, and into the Oscars. Look for La La Land, Moonlight, not as much, because I think the Academy's a little afraid of some of the issues in that one, but La La Land, Jackie, Manchester by the Sea, those are the ones you're going to be hearing a lot of. You didn't hear as much about Arrival. Arrival got a lot of nominations, but didn't get any big significant wins. The next piece of news I want to talk about is something that actually hit the news cycle a while back, and I didn't notice it. I mean, a couple weeks ago. And I heard about it in sort of a retaliation kind of news story. Apparently, Amy Schumer has taken her critics to task when she was rumored to be in the running for the role of Barbie. Sony is developing a Barbie movie, and they wanted to get Amy Schumer to play Barbie. And of course, there are people that rightfully so said, "Whoa, hold on a second. She's not really the Barbie type." And I guess that's what they're trying to do, is sort of break those norms that the toy has, which apparently doesn't really work terribly well for Sony. I mean, look at all the norms they tried to break with Ghostbusters and what a disaster that was this year. But people sort of questioned it. And she jumped back, "Oh, well, you know, just the fact that you're questioning me being able to be in this role shows that I should be in this role." Okay, now let's just pump the brakes here for a second. For Amy Schumer to be Barbie, sort of the iconic Barbie, you have to fundamentally change the character. Barbie is, she's a Kardashian, a blonde Kardashian, like Paris Hilton or Ivanka Trump. She's about fashion and about looking pretty and being tall and statuesque. That's what she's known for. And even if you look at the stuff that they're marketing now, these animated CGI Barbie cartoons that are going direct to DVD, they're still on that level of being cool and pretty and stylish. And of course, being yourself, sure, but of course, Barbie's always cool and stylish and pretty. You'd have to change that fundamentally. It's like, you know, we're talking Star Wars this week. So if you were to make Luke Skywalker not be Luke Skywalker, you know, if you're going to recast a Luke Skywalker and make him a big, fat, wisecracking goofball, you'd fundamentally change the character of Luke Skywalker. And that's what's happening with Barbie. And this isn't even about a weight and body type issue, because I really don't care. Although, let's face it, it cuts both ways. Ryan Gosling would not be allowed to pack on the pounds permanently for anything. And Chris Pratt, look at how much weight he had to lose to suddenly become a big box office success. And I guarantee you that if he put on 100 pounds between Guardians of the Galaxy 2 and like Infinity War, Marvel's going to step in. It's not just women on this. But it is kind of about body shape and type. I mean, like, remember when Rosie O'Donnell was cast in Exit to Eden about 20 years ago? A BDSM fantasy movie? People were like, wait a minute, this is Rosie O'Donnell. You're going to be putting her in leather and latex? And that movie was a notorious bomb and didn't do well with critics or audiences. Or like when she was Betty Rubble in The Flintstones. I mean, I'm kind of picking on Rosie O'Donnell here, but when she was cast as Betty in The Flintstone movie back about 20 years ago, I remember everybody at the time, I was in my 20s, and I'm like, well, hold on a second. Betty was the hot one. And you cast somebody who's definitively not hot, even beyond all that. Casting Amy Schumer is a bad idea because of kind of what her comedy is. Her comedy is almost exclusively based on raunchy and sexual joke stand-up. And that would be like tapping like Joey Bishop back in the 60s to play Santa Claus. Or in the modern world to get Chelsea Handler to play a live-action version of Doc McStuffins. Or Andrew Dice Clay, Lewis Black, or someone like that to do a Toy Story remake. I mean, that just is... She's not Barbie in any sense, aside from the fact that she's a female and has kind of blonde hair. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. I did not talk about the Spider-Man Homecoming trailer last week, so let's hit that one really quick. It opens on July 7th.
So to become an Avenger, are there like trials or an interview?
Just don't do anything I would do. And definitely don't do anything I wouldn't do. There's a little gray area in there, and that's where you operate. You're not ready yet.
Forget the flying monster guy. There are people who handle this sort of thing.
I'm sick of him treating me like a kid all the time.
But you are a kid.
This is my chance to prove myself.
At first, I was worried because I thought this was going to be found footage, because the teaser trailer was a found footage bit. And I was like, holy crap. Please tell me that Marvel didn't go the found footage route. And they didn't. Obviously, you can tell by this trailer. It's full-blown, just regular Marvel filmmaking. And it looks good. I'm looking forward to it. I like the fact they're not doing an origin story. I like the fact they're tying an Iron Man in there, giving him a... I mean, I swear to God, I think Robert Downey Jr. has starred as Iron Man in more movies than are named Iron Man. So I think he's having fun just doing that. And I wouldn't be surprised if he sticks around doing that longer by not being the main character. But I'm looking forward to Spider-Man Homecoming. It'll be nice to see that rolled into the Marvel Universe. The other one I want to hit is The Fate of the Furious, one of the dumbest names of a movie ever. And that opens on April 14th.
Did you ever think you'd betray your family the way you did today?
Dominic Toretto just turned on us.
Well, well, well. Did you look at that?
I don't know why he's doing this,
but that wasn't dumb.
She's the very definition of high-tech terrorism. And now she's working with your guy.
I think I found my team.
This should be interesting.
This looks really dumb. I'm sorry. I mean, and all the Fast and Furious movies are dumb. They're not smart films. They're not smartly written, and they don't make logical sense. But they're at least a certain degree of fun. Now this one just looks stupid. And can we talk about Charlize Theron? She looks like a porcelain doll in this movie. It looks like she has had so much Botox, her face doesn't even move, which is a shame because she's a beautiful woman. Anyways, the action is ridiculous, and the story, it looks like such a stretch, and they're sort of reminding plot points they've had in the past. It looks terrible, but it'll make $1 billion, so what do I care? That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Collateral Beauty and All Through the House. seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Before we talk about Star Wars, I'm going to keep you in suspense. We're going to be talking about Collateral Beauty, which is the new Will Smith movie. After the death of his six-year-old daughter by a rare disease, a business executive channels his grief by writing letters to death, love, and time, never expecting to get a personal answer.
Howard is a brilliant man, and he's not just a boss, he's a friend. He lost his child, and now he doesn't care if he loses everything else.
This might be the strangest thing I have ever come across. He writes letters.
Who are they to?
Howard doesn't write letters to people. He writes to things. Time. Love. Death.
You don't think I'm crazy,
but I'm having conversations. Death came first.
Charmed, I'm sure.
When it comes to marketing movies, it is essential to make a trailer that's not just compelling, but that's truthful. It does the movie no good to make a trailer that essentially lies to you. Now, you also don't want to have a trailer that gives too much away, but you don't want a trailer to market a movie a certain way and have it not be that way. There is a minefield in cinema history of movies that were poorly marketed by trailer. And I've seen movies before that purport to be something that they're not. And a lot of these you don't remember because they've flopped. And that's one of the many problems with Collateral Beauty. If you watch the trailer, you get the sense that he wrote these letters, sent them out into the universe, and the universe replied. That's not what the movie's about. Love, death, and taxes and time don't just show up on his doorstep. They are hired by his friends at work. And this is not a spoiler. This is not something that is revealed later. This is the progression of events in the movie. This is the setup, essentially. So his coworkers want to sell the company. So they go to these actors and get them to play these roles so they can prove that he's incompetent to make business decisions. And they hire a private investigator and they're going to videotape him reacting so that they can question his sanity, essentially. They're a-holes. Like, huge. The level of emotional manipulation that is purported to be compassion in this movie is sickening. But on top of the whole thing, you would go to this movie expecting this magical movie that hopes to act as a salve to the pain of grief and guilt. And what you get is a Scooby-Doo plot where somebody's wearing a mask, essentially. And again, I reiterate, this is not a spoiler about the movie. This is the setup of the film. And it annoyed me. I was like, oh, this is terrible. These characters are bad people. Now, there's a little more to it that goes on. I'm not going to give anything away, but there are twists and turns and big surprises here and there. And every single one you can see coming a mile away. No, you could see it coming miles away. You could see it coming from another planet. It is such a predictable film. Now, I mean, Will Smith, poor guy, he's acting his heart out in this movie. I mean, he's really throwing down. The performance is good. The character's crap. The other characters are bad people. The emotional resonance on there is so button pushy and false and extreme that it doesn't work. Whereas if you want to see a movie about real grief and guilt and real life problems, go see Manchester by the Sea. This is like blowing your Kleenex into Manchester by the Sea. This is not a good film. And a lot of the reason for it is because of the basic setup, which is in a lot of ways just horrifying when you really look at it. It'd be like if you went to a movie theater and saw a trailer for a ghost story, something really intense, Conjuring or Insidious or something like that, one of these modern ghost stories. And then you went to go see the movie on good faith that it was going to be a ghost story. And it's not even that that's the twist at the end that's, oh, it was a hoax, or it really was somebody in the walls, which we've seen in movies a couple times before. No, if when they get there, the first scene, they're like, oh, we're going to pretend to be ghosts and have them go into a haunted house and then pretend to be ghosts for the next 90 minutes. You'd be ticked off at a movie like that, as I would, because it's not delivering what you went to go see. And that's, again, the starting problem for Collateral Beauty. And I mean, it has a great cast. I mean, it's a brilliant cast, and everybody does a good job acting in it. Helen Mirren, though, looks like she's been over Botoxed. Another actress I'm talking about that looks over Botoxed. I mean, Helen Mirren, she was growing old gracefully, and they did something weird to her face. Maybe because she was going to be sharing close-up time with Keira Knightley, who you just can't win on that one. Helen, you're an elderly woman, and Keira Knightley's, what, in her 30s? Oh, this movie annoyed me and irritated me, and there was no way for it to recover. No matter how good its intentions were, it was crap. So I'm going to have to say Collateral Beauty totally sucks. It is not a surprise that they abandoned this during award season.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's turn our sights to a Christmas movie. Maybe not a traditional Christmas movie. No, I'm not talking about Die Hard. Oh my God, we quit. You know what's funny about the Die Hard thing? Let me just interject about Die Hard. When you see people putting Facebook posts about Die Hard being a Christmas movie, I've never heard anyone say, that's not a Christmas movie. All I see is people going, I'm watching Die Hard and it's a Christmas movie. Don't say anything or I'll fight you. Dial it back, people. No one's stopping you from watching Die Hard at Christmas. Can we stop insisting it's a Christmas movie? Because who cares? If you think it's a Christmas movie, watch it. But this is a different type of Christmas movie. Not even like Die Hard. It's a Christmas movie, very clearly. It has a Santa Claus in it. But it's a horror movie. And that is all through the house. In this tribute to the 1980s slasher films, a deranged maniac in a Santa suit spends Christmas Eve killing people with a set of hedge trimmers.
My life was not the same when Jamie was taken from me. A pity. She could have been like you. You see, baby? They don't want to play with you. They ain't nothing but a bunch of naughty little children.
Rachel, you gotta get out of that house.
This, of course, channeling movies like Silent Night, Deadly Night, or Christmas Evil, or the original Tales from the Crypt movie where Joan Collins is attacked by a psychotic Santa. These are traditional, fun slasher movies. If you don't like horror movies, you don't like blood, don't watch this movie. You shouldn't even try and get this one. It's on demand anywhere, really. I don't know if it's playing in too many theaters right now, but like I said, you can get it on demand. I have to say, though, I mean, I like 80s slasher movies. In the most part, it sort of channels them. Reminds me of that movie Clown Town that I reviewed a couple months back around Halloween, where it totally channeled what you needed to for a slasher movie. I mean, it has breasts and blood and kills and the evil Santa. What's funny is I have an ornament on my tree that looks like this evil Santa. And I was kind of shocked when I started watching the movie because I was like, ah, it's on my tree. It's like the silver-faced Santa with these black eyes. I don't know who thought that would be charming. It's on the back of the tree, so it's facing out. So this movie, it's just a bloody good time. It's fun. It has a really nice sort of payoff at the end, like any good slasher movie should. It doesn't just go through the motions. It actually has something. And yes, I appreciate the breasts. Thank you for the nudies. So if you've already been through Silent Night, Deadly Night, and Christmas Evil, and Tales from the Crypt, why not check out All Through the House? Like I said, it's available on VOD. I'm going to have to say that All Through the House kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, and Naruto. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. Before I do Rogue One, a Star Wars story, I know I'm being a jerk here. I'm just teasing and putting it off and putting it off. I'll talk about that in a couple seconds. I have to, just out of good manners, talk about the movie Naruto, which opens this week in a very limited release. It's a foreign film, so I'm not playing a trailer, but the basic gist of it is, after joining the Communist Party, a beloved Chilean poet slash politician goes on the run, and he's hunted by a government agent. Now, it's a Chilean movie. It's in Spanish, which is why I didn't play a trailer. I also don't know anything about Chile. I've seen a lot of movies about Chile lately for some reason, but there have always been like these weird, obscure offshoots. Like there was that one with Emma Watson and Daniel Brühl. They're in the middle of a Chilean uprising, and she was put into a, they were put into concentration camps. And then there was another one, Aftershock, a couple years ago, the one about there was a earthquake and all these people had to go run and hide, and it just, the worst things happened to them along the way. It was an Eli Roth produced and acted in project. But overall, I don't know anything about Chile. I like most Americans, I'm completely ignorant of South America. I'm just saying, like, well, there's this big South America-ish nation down there and they do things. Oh, and then Brazil was once run by the Portuguese. And that's about all I know. I mean, I really don't. And I admit, I'm fully ignorant of Chilean politics and culture. Which made this movie, it was as much a foreign film as it could be for me. Because, I mean, it was well made. It looks good. And the acting's really good. And actually, the production design and the cinematography are really slick. I mean, along the level of something you see in Live by Night, when that comes out a little bit later, Ben Affleck's sort of gangster thriller, it has that richness to it. I couldn't connect to it whatsoever. And that's why I'm just going to give it such short shrift here. Because it reminded me of when I was in Jerusalem, covering the Jerusalem Film Festival. I went and saw this documentary about some Israeli music star. This guy who was sort of, I mean, it's sort of like the Smothers Brothers almost, an Israeli version of a single guy who was a Smothers Brothers. And he had this song that apparently was really popular in Israel. It's all in Hebrew. And apparently, to your average Israeli, everyone knows who this guy is. I had no idea, because I'm a big, fat, dumb American, and I don't know anything about Israeli culture from the late 70s. I was like, wow, that's kind of interesting. I didn't know anything about that guy, but it's an interesting life, and I feel the same way about Naruto. It's a well-made movie. If you understand Chilean politics and you speak Spanish, it should speak to you. It's a well-made movie. I don't know anything about it. So I'm going to have to say, still, for at least its construction, it kind of rocked.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now it's finally time to talk some Star Wars, and let's talk about Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. The first spinoff film from the Star Wars universe tells the story of a ragtag group of rebels who steal the plans for the Death Star.
Our rebellion is all that remains to push back the Empire. You think you might be able to help us?
When was the last time you were in contact with your father?
What is this? It appears he is critical to the development of a super weapon.
The power that we are dealing with here is immeasurable.
If the Empire has this kind of power, what chance do we have?
If you've ever dabbled in the extended universe stuff of Star Wars, you know, back even the early as the 70s and 80s, there was comic books by Marvel. Alan Dean Foster wrote a couple books. They really got rich in the 90s when they started doing media tie-ins, and they did role-playing games and comic books and video games. This is not an unfamiliar thing. It's a story that sort of takes place behind the story. It doesn't involve the main characters. It's not a Luke and Leia, Han Solo kind of movie. But there's a lot of people out there who just have seen the movies and really don't know where it falls. I'm just going to tell you, it falls literally right before episode 4 starts, right before the original Star Wars begins. I mean, you could edit it completely, almost seamlessly, into the original Star Wars. And it's just about them stealing the plans. You know, the plans that Princess Leia sticks into R2-D2 and they take to Tatooine, and then they eventually get back to the Rebel base and figure out to shoot things in the exhaust port to blow up the entire Death Star. It's those plans. The people who steal them. Now, I was a little nervous about this when it first was announced because Gareth Edwards was given the role to direct. And while I enjoyed Monsters, which was a relatively small budgeted, limited scope film about these people kind of trying to avoid monsters in a wasteland, he kind of did the same thing with Godzilla, which isn't a Godzilla movie. He spent more time not showing Godzilla and cutting away from Godzilla. And then when you watch the special features of the Blu-ray, he's all giddy going, "Aha, I thought that would be funny to do." It wasn't. It was annoying. If I see a Godzilla movie, I want to see monster smackdowns, and I wasn't seeing that. So I was nervous that he was going to try and make a Star Wars movie and not put anything in there that was Star Wars. Well, Disney and Lucasfilm, I'm sure, had a heavy hand on him from the concept stage. And, you know, the first 10 minutes, you know, it's against spaceships and lasers and droids and aliens. And there's action sequences. So it is bona fide Star Wars. It is there. My favorite nerdy minutia of the movie is the fact that the technology and, like, the buckles and things that are putting together just clothes and gear looks like it was built in the 1970s. So it looks contemporary to the original Star Wars movies, which is a great restraint on Hollywood, because Hollywood always wants to make stuff as slick and as cool and modern as possible. But this is supposed to be in that war of attrition, in that long-fought battle against the Empire, before the rebels get the upper hand in A New Hope. So I got giddy at seeing all that stuff. And there's some neat little cameos in it here and there. I mean, everybody knows about Darth Vader being in the movie, and he's not in it a lot. I mean, it's like more than an hour before he even shows up. But there's other bits and pieces and little cameos that show up. And you're like, oh, look at that. And there's this. And that's a little callback to that movie. So, I mean, if you're like a Star Wars geek and you know the franchise backwards and forwards, you're going to be like me. And you're going to enjoy the heck out of that. But ultimately, as a core of a story, it works. It's a little darker. It's a little more grim. It's not as lighthearted. I mean, even episode 7, you have some heavy duty stuff happening in episode 7, but it was still kind of this playful romp. You know, Finn and Poe and Rey and BB-8, there was a lot of cuteness and fun and whimsical quirkiness going on. You don't get as much here. Most of it's in the hands of this droid voiced by Alan Tudyk. And I think some of it actually, at least to me, looked like stuff that was added in reshoots because there was a rumor going around that it needed to be a little lighter. But it works. It gives you that feel. You certainly feel you're in a Star Wars movie. And to that end, the main characters, these rebels, mainly Felicity Jones and Diego Luna, they're the two rebels who are sort of leading this smuggling run, they're not terribly well developed. And they're a little two-dimensional. But that makes sense for the kind of movie it is, because it's just a standalone movie. They're not the new Han, Luke, and Leia. I mean, they're not Finn, Rey, and Poe. They are in there for this movie, and that's it. You're not having an offshoot of the stories of Jin for the next 6 movies. This is just to plug this little hole, and it does answer some questions that have been dogging the movie since the 70s. And it's sort of a prequel, but it's still a full-blown Star Wars movie, and it still has that epic feel. It still is a large-screen movie. And there's in-atmosphere ship battles, which is really cool. That was just started and teased at in The Force Awakens. And you have some really brilliant space shots. And so, I mean, stuff that I remember seeing in movies like Prometheus. You say what you want to about Prometheus, but the opening sequences of the ship flying to the planet are gorgeous. And they really look like a deeper, more complex universe. And you have that in this movie. And that's brilliant. And I think that's awesome. And if there's any real complaints I have about it, is there's a couple script issues. Like I said, the characters aren't as detailed, but you're not going to get multiple movies on these guys. And there's some corny writing. Like, well, there's one teeth-grinding pun that Vader does, and it's terrible. And being darker does not mean that kids aren't going to like it, too. I mean, let me tell you something. If this had come out in 1978, my 6-year-old self would have lost his mind. This would have been everything that I wanted from a Star Wars sequel or prequel. It didn't matter that I have to wait for Empire Strikes Back a couple years later. If this had come out right afterwards, I would have been the happiest kid on the planet, because this covers everything. And it does have that nostalgia feel, just because of the technology and the found items look of everything in this war of attrition. Ben Mendelsohn kind of steals the show as the bad guy. There's other things I don't want to talk about because there are spoilers to that. But Rogue One, a Star Wars story, totally works, and I'm completely on board, and now I'm looking forward to not just episode 8 and 9, but all the other spinoff movies as well. Rogue One totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to review the movie Camera Store and talk to John Rhys Davies about it. I'll also talk about the box office and the home cinema roundup. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. For the final segment, we got one more movie to talk about, and that is Camera Store. On Christmas Eve 1994, a bitter old camera store manager finds his life and career coming to a reckoning.
You know that every photograph has two sides, right? The positive and the negative.
Polaroid film. Triple pack.
Very good choice, sir. Excellent film.
I mean, here at Bibideau, all we can do is offer 25 years of unflagging service. Yorktown is cheaper.
Top of the morning to you on this blessed Christmas Eve day.
Pinky, I don't even know who I am and what is left but the negative.
This movie kind of fell in my lap. It's got a very small release, and it actually opened last week. So it's in select cities, and I know it's playing in Cleveland. Down in like St. Petersburg, Florida, various places around the country, a dozen or so cities. And I'm assuming it's going to hit DVD and on demand soon. But since it's right before Christmas and it takes place at Christmas Eve, I thought I'd give a little bit of a discussion about this movie. And I'll be talking about John Rhys Davies, who plays a supporting role in the film, in a couple minutes. But first, my take on the movie. This came to my lap from a publicist that I know who had the last movie that I had worked with this person on was in a little bit more schmaltzy. It was a little more of a Hallmark kind of movie. So I was kind of expecting that going into this movie, but I was sent the link. And as I start watching it, I'm like, whoa, this is not Hallmark. There's nothing crass in it, but there's a lot of language in it. There's a lot of F-bombs dropped. It's about a couple bitter people at the end of their lives, at the end of their career, surrounded by sort of the happy glow of Christmas in this mall, but it takes place over 20 years ago, and it's where camera stores are starting to die. Now, it's a little bit anachronistic because you really didn't see cameras and camera stores getting destroyed until well into the new century, but, you know, you're just bumping it ahead a little bit. But it's at a time where digital was just around the corner, but not at all close enough to take them over completely. The real push of this movie is John Larroquette playing the main role as the guy who's the camera store manager. And he's fantastic in it. You forget how good of an actor John Larroquette really is because he hasn't been in a bunch of stuff lately. And his TV stuff was always sort of comedy, but he's real dark and has a real sardonic look. And this is a very grim, very cynical movie, but it does have little shreds of hope in it and shreds of redemption and shreds of freedom in it. But it should at the end make you look at your life and say, am I wasting it by giving my time to somebody else? So it's hardly a standard Christmas movie, but my little cynical SOB self kind of fell in love with this movie. I was surprised at how much I did enjoy it. I mean, it can be depressing at times. You'll hear John Rhys Davies refer to it as something like Death of a Salesman, where you're really watching something wind down. You're looking at everything that could have been, that never will be, even though there's some time left on the old ticker. There's some schmaltzy moments to it, and there's some, well, I'd say, stuff that feels very low-budget, independent film in terms of some of the characters, but it's really just, it's a character study. It could be a play, just all taking place in this one camera store as these guys sort of see their career and as a symbol of their lives ticking away and disappearing. So I'm going to have to say I really kind of like Camera Store. My cynical heart was charmed by it. And so I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. On that note, let's hear a little interview I did with John Rhys Davies, who plays one of the characters named Pinky in The Camera Store. And if you want to hear the full interview, go to fatguysatthemovies.com. I got the whole thing posted there. If you don't know who he is, he's had one heck of a career. He played Saul in the Indiana Jones movies, and he was Gimli the Dwarf in the original Lord of the Rings movies. So yeah, here you go. This is my conversation with the charming and wonderful John Rhys Davies.
I think it's a marvelous script, and I think Lara Kett is just magnificent in it. Just wonderful. We all got on so well. It was a real joy to be part of. And it has a resonance. There is that sort of bittersweet, you know, death of a salesman sort of quality about it. It has a vigor and an underlying requiem of sadness about it that I think gives it a gravitas that I love.
Was this the first time you'd worked with John Larroquette?
First time ever, yes. The real chemistry starts when you look at the other actor and just listen to what he's saying. Yeah. Listen not just to the words coming out in the right order that you recognize from the script, but really listen. And instinctively, if you're listening properly, you answer. That is the magic of human relationships.
Yeah. Most people recognize you, obviously, for, you know, Sala from the Indiana Jones movies, Gimli from Lord of the Rings. Which do you prefer? Do you prefer the bigger movies, or do you prefer a smaller, intimate, you know, just a couple people in a shop kind of movie?
What I like is a good story. I mean, I don't mind what it is. I'm a spoiled brat. Almost every day of my professional life has been a working day. And I just love getting up in the morning, and I don't care what bloody time it is, and going to work and trying to take the jigsaw puzzle of a writer's dream or a director's dream and try putting those pieces together. What can I say? I would do this for free, and thank God they pay me sometimes.
Would you feel comfortable in labeling this a Christmas movie?
I hope that after watching White Christmas, that there's time for people to have a little look at this as well. This performance had to be the right size. I mean, because Pinky is a larger-than-life character in the way that a person who's out of control and whose life is spiraling out of control often is, you know, too drunk, too noisy, too hysterical, too vulnerable. But it has to be pitched right on that edge. There's a point at which it's too much, and yet it has to be dangerous enough to just be a man fraying.
I had heard that you originally weren't going to do the role. Is that correct, that it took you some time to come to the role? Is that true?
The first time I looked at it, I was wondering, he is a pretty awful monster, isn't it, Ray? And this is a very dark piece. But I read it again, and I have real time for our director. And I've got a great time for Lara Kett. I'd never met him, but I'd liked his work. And as I began to look at the script, I realized that it was a lovely script. It was bloody dark, but yeah, a lovely script. And I didn't need much persuading, actually. I mean, once I'd talked to the director, I was hooked.
You ever planning on retiring?
No, actors shouldn't retire. Actually, people shouldn't retire. Die in the saddle. Retirement, it means that basically you're waiting for the next event, and the next event is not a good thing.
Is there anything else you'd like to add about the movie?
This is a very rich story. It's a moving story. It's a touching story. It is a bit savage, a bit dark, a bit out of the way, and yet gloriously heartwarming as well.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the box office. Last week I said about $15 million for Moana. Again, it overperformed. It did $18.5 million, which is really good. And then Office Christmas Party came in a close second. with almost 17 million. It'll probably do really well on video next year. So that's one for the investors to look at. Now this week, the big one's going to be Rogue One. I mean, I don't think there's anybody expecting anything but Rogue One to rule the box office, especially when last week it didn't, the top film didn't even crack 20 million for that frame. Nobody really knows because this isn't quite episode 8. It's not even episode 3.5. So I'm just going to say a conservative $130 million for the opening. It's going to be nowhere near episode 7's numbers from last year, but it's going to come in second in all of the record books for the highest opening weekend, probably the highest Thursday nights, even for any time, let alone just December. So that's going to definitely top the box office. I think Collateral Beauty is going to sink. I think word of mouth is going to kill the movie because even though there's some people that want the schmaltziness, it just doesn't have what it takes, and it's only going to live a little bit on Will Smith's stardom. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Really quick, we got to plow through these movies. I'm just going to list these because if you need last-minute Christmas presents, these are the ones to check out. Suicide Squad, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, Bridget Jones's Baby, Morgan, Florence Foster Jenkins, and Ben-Hur in terms of the regular new movies. Those are all out this week on DVD and Blu-ray. And if you want to catch up on some TV, you've got Fear of the Walking Dead Season 2 and The Twilight Zone, the complete series on Blu-ray. That is it for this week. Next week's going to be our big fat Christmas special, and I'll be talking about Why Him, Assassin's Creed, Passengers, and Sing. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.